Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome all of you to our Sunday afternoon plenary session. My name is Bill Jordan, and I'm a member of the Executive Council of the ASA. We're pleased to have with us Gail Walshak. She is Professor of Radiation Oncology, Radiology, and Cell and Molecular Biology in the Feinberg School of Medicine, Northwestern University. She is a PhD from the University of Toledo in Medical Sciences. She's an untypical scientist here because she also has a seminary degree. She holds a Doctor of Ministries degree from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary in Eastern Christian Studies and is an adjunct faculty member at the Lutheran School of Theology, Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, and St. Vladimir's Orthodox Seminary. She's going to speak on perspectives on life and creation. So let's welcome Dr. Walshak.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me here. This is my first ASA conference ever, although I've been an ASA member in the past, so I guess it's a good opportunity for me. I've really enjoyed the talks and the discussions that are going on in the corridors are maybe even more enjoying than the talks, so that's a good thing. What I'm going to talk about today is I'm a biologist by training, and I'm going to talk about some perspectives that come to us from biology that are perhaps things we should reflect upon theologically. So I love this quote from Thomas Jefferson. He said, "For if one link in nature's chain might be lost, another might be lost until the whole of things will vanish by piecemeal." He was talking about the connectedness of nature and how things are dependent upon each other and how life is dependent upon life. I'm going to use this as a theme throughout, and you're going to hear this kind of reflection coming through in many different perspectives. So the overall themes that I'll talk about today are that evolution is the unifying theory within biology, and that nothing in biology makes sense without it. And I'm even going to comment that life can be defined as that which evolves. That evolution is tightly linked to ecology. And failure to accept evolution often leads to a failure to accept ecological principles. And then finally, extinction is a natural part of evolution of life on Earth, but human causes may be responsible for many more extinctions than were are envisioned, even if one considers natural extinctions. Okay, so evolution as the unifying theory. So Theodosius Dobzhansky was a scholar. And in 1973, he was actually an evolutionary biologist whose father was an Orthodox priest, and he was a practicing Orthodox Christian. He reflected on what was going on in his time, and he said, "Let me try to make crystal clear what is established beyond reasonable doubt and what needs further study about evolution. Evolution as a process that has always gone on in the history of the earth can be doubted only by those who are ignorant of the evidence or are resistant to evidence, owing to emotional blocks or to plain bigotry. By contrast, the mechanisms that bring evolution about certainly need study and clarification. There are no alternatives to evolution as history that can withstand critical examination. Yet we are constantly learning new and important facts about evolutionary mechanisms." He wrote this in 1973, and actually when he wrote it, it was not terribly controversial. This has become more and more controversial recently, probably in the last 10 to 15 years. But in 1970s, this was not really that shocking to the broad community. Here's Charles Darwin, whose image I put before you. Several scholars that have spoken up here have put him up as well. I want to kind of know the face that we're talking about here. Evolution requires a definition, and it is very important, in my opinion, to distinguish biological evolution from all those other kinds of evolution that exist. So astronomers will talk about planetary evolution. You will hear people talking about chemical evolution. There are all kinds of things that get discussed as evolution. But evolution was born as a principle in biology, and biological evolution is distinct from all other kinds of evolution. When people want to pull in social evolution, It does not have the same principles as biological evolution. When people want to pull in planetary evolution, it does not have the same principles as biological evolution. So this is what Futuyama says in his textbook, which is, I think, probably one of the best textbooks on evolutionary biology. He said, in the broadest sense, evolution is merely change, and so is all pervasive. Galaxies, languages, and political systems all evolve. Biological evolution is change in the properties of populations, of organisms that transcend the lifetime of a single individual. The ontogeny of an individual is not considered evolution. Individual organisms do not evolve. The changes in populations that are considered evolutionary are those that are inheritable via the genetic material from one generation to the next. Biological evolution may be slight or substantial. It embraces everything from slight changes in the proportion of different alleles within a population, such as those determining blood types, to the successive alteration that led from the earliest protoorganisms to snails, bees, giraffes, and dandelions. This is the definition that we use in evolutionary biology, and in fact is the definition that biologists as a whole use. Biologists would claim that this idea of evolution includes natural selection, includes genetic diversity, and all those aspects which were probably not described adequately by Darwin, because Darwin didn't even know that DNA was the genetic material. So he would have no means of even knowing about how evolution occurs. The principles that Darwin put forth were four main concepts. That there's a common ancestry for all of life on Earth, that species develop through variations in form, which we now call mutations, that natural selection, which people call survival of the fittest often, in a way appropriately, but there are some problems with that definition, that it selects variations and drives speciation, the formation of different species, and that extinction is a part of natural selection. So these were the principles that Darwin put forth. And I don't think all of these principles that were part of evolution apply to other systems outside of biology. In particular, I get very nervous when people start to talk about social evolution as being survival of the best culture or survival of the best system. That works well for biology. It does not translate to other mechanisms. So I think it's dangerous to start to apply it without the proper adjectives in front of it. So this was actually a diagram that came from Darwin's Origin of the Species. I think my pointer, do you see my pointer here or not? Yes, okay. So you will notice that on this tree, this was a tree of life that he drew, and there are these little, like, empty spots that form. In these examples, he was predicting extinction. So he said, look, species will continue to develop, they will evolve. But there will be species that will not be able to compete successfully, and they will go into extinction. So this was his proposal for extinction back in his original text. So I think that I'd like to draw some conclusions and then draw some supporting data to show you that this is true. So the theory of evolution is supported not just from the concepts that Darwin had, but now we've sequenced genomes. We can identify those sequences and see that there is absolutely total evidence in support of evolution. As we get the DNA sequences of the complete genomes of human beings, and there are many that are now available, and other organisms, and you can actually go into the web and pull sequence data right off the web. Go to an NIH website called GenBank, and you can get the sequence for almost anything that's been sequenced. In fact, it's required by the U.S. government that if you sequence something, you must enter it into GenBank because the government paid for the work, so therefore it should be available to everybody. And so then you can actually ask questions about evolution. How much are two... I'm a dog lover. How much are two different strains of dogs related from an evolutionary perspective? How much are they related to wolves? How much are they related to foxes, to coyotes? All of these are questions that people can do, hypothetically driven, but looking at absolute data. So they never have to go into the laboratory. They can just look at the data that exists on websites and analyze it. Again, I'll say, evolution is the unifying theory of biology. But at some point in time, we have to put humanity in context, in this context of where do we fit within evolution? How do we fit within our world? And the first point I always bring up is that we share elements with the Earth. So our Earth is made up of water, and we are 90-some percent water. Our Earth is made up of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and all those things, and so are we. And so is all of life on Earth. So we share those common elements from the periodic table. We share them because we are born from the same material as our planet is. We share genes, pathways, and processes with other species. But then again, we have to ask the question, how are we unique? What makes humanity be different from other species? If we are all the same, if we are related, what makes us be unique? And I guess the things I tend to point out are issues in particular of creativity. Creativity is one of those things that I think is some spark that comes to especially in something that is undefined. So let me give an example. My students come in the lab to work. I can tell them, go do this experiment. I can tell them, go write a paper. But I can't tell them, go be creative. Creativity does not come when you demand it. It does not come by any sort of mechanism that we can induce. It comes where it will. It blows like the wind. And I believe is somehow some mark of the Holy Spirit on us that allows us to have this, to have creativity when we go to do our work. It is something that is not programmed or it can't be justified. I think other species do have some responsibility for each other. I actually have sister dogs, and I watch them have responsibility for each other. They're kind of cute, as one is making sure the other one walks in the right place and doesn't get lost or anything else. So I think that there is a sense of responsibility, but I think responsibility among humans is probably unique because of its depth. We feel responsible for, in a way, everything around us, for each other, for people we don't know, for our planet, for our animals, for everything. That sense of responsibility is very deep and very great. Another issue to bring up is that we are all out of Africa. The humans evolved, began in Africa, and migrated out into Europe and to everywhere else. So we do have a common origin, and that origin is in Africa, probably someplace around Kenya. We are a product of our environment and our genes. Are we all about our environment? No. But are we all about our genes? No. So let me give examples that are kind of shocking. Minnesota did a twin study a number of years ago. Now, what's the story with identical twins? Identical twins have identical genomes. And they asked to do a study of twins that were identical twins that were raised apart. So they didn't have the same environment, but they had the same genetics. And what is really weird is that there are common themes that came out. They all had the same lawn furniture on their front yard. They often wore the same pajamas. They named their first child frequently the same name, and in one case, the name was Jean, and it was gene for a male in one example and gene for a female in the other. These are not things I think most of us would have thought are genetic. Yet they were coming out as being genetically related. By the same token, there are things we do think that are genetic that aren't always genetic. So for instance, among these twin studies, you know what? They did not all develop leukemia with concordance. They didn't all get cancer with concordance. So things that we think are genetic probably have at least some environmental component, and probably at least a few of the things that we think are environmental have a genetic component. And sifting this out is going to be the work of probably another 50 years or more, because it is very complicated. Some of the genes that are involved in behavior there are 120 or 150 genes that are involved in behavioral mechanisms. It's not going to be simple. And it's going to be very complicated, and it's going to influence how we think about things. Finally, we are the part of creation that contemplates as human beings. And because of that, we have a weighty responsibility. Much as I love my dogs, they do not contemplate nature. I do not believe it. They look at the squirrel to catch it, but that's about as deep as it goes. But we contemplate nature. We go for a walk in the woods and have a deep experience. It's up to us to think about how that contemplation can help us progress better as human beings on this planet. So a couple of points to bring out that are implications that come from evolution. First of all, a few people here today have said that creation is ongoing. There are some that would say that creation is even eternal. My favorite theologian, Orthodox theologian who passed away in 1949, he said, his name is Sergei Bulgakov, he said, is there a time when God is not creator? So is creation perpetual, going into eternity? Now, I also want to introduce a heresy that everybody here will throw tomatoes at me for, but I want to at least suggest that there can be changes in the way we think about natural laws as laws. So I'm the biologist. I'm going to use the example from biology. When life was evolving on planet Earth, we probably didn't start from DNA. We don't know where we started from, but we probably started from RNA or something similar. Most models that have been done, most experiments that have tried to create primordial Earth and looked at it, they said it looks like it's RNA. So there's a sense in which the central dogma of all of biology, which is that DNA is the most important ingredient and that DNA makes RNA makes protein, that couldn't have happened in those days. So what we see as central dogma now, during the first beginnings of chemical life, probably were not quite the same. And if you talk to a physicist, they'll tell you that at least some of the components that happened at the Big Bang were unique and different than what we would find today. So I think laws become very much what we define and how we define them. I actually think laws are a gift from God. The laws of nature help us to be predictive. They help us to predict what's going to happen. So therefore, they're a gift. It helps us to be better because we can predict when we drop something, it will really fall and not wonder what's going to happen to it. So I see the laws of nature as a gift, but I think we need to realize that there may be some inflexibility. There may be more flexibility there than we think. Extinction is natural. I've already said that. And a few speakers have said this. I will just say it again, that the life death cycle that we experience is actually necessary for evolution and is necessary for life on this planet. If things don't die, there can't be space for new ones. In fact, I even argue that, sometimes death is actually a blessing for us. I mean, you know, there are rulers like Hitler or Mussolini who, you know, if they had never died, think about what our planet might be like now. So death can be a gift in a way, in a very strange way. Okay, so how do we define life? There are lots of people that say that it is alive if it grows, if it responds to the environment, if it's got cellular structure, if it metabolizes, if it has stable conditions that we would call homeostasis, if it's got heredity, if it can reproduce offspring, and probably it's all these combinations, but that there are some organisms that don't fit into this model. For instance, the cellular structure and composition, viruses don't have that. There are certain kinds of approaches to growth and development in single-celled organisms that are meaningless. There are some metabolic processes that actually don't happen. Viruses don't have metabolic processes. So do we consider viruses to be dead and everything else to be living? How do we, you know, look at this model? I actually like the model that says that our fundamental principle is that evolution is a driving model in biology. So I like to think that life is that which evolved. Right now, it is complicated. We've tried to say it is that which reproduces, it is that which has these different metabolisms. While life begins with metabolism, it actually really began with evolution. The first organisms, when they could divide and select for what would be best in that environment, were undergoing evolution. What Wikipedia says is a little broader than that, and I'm a Wikipedia fan. I'll go with it. It says, living organisms are open systems that maintain homeostasis, are composed of cells, have a life cycle, undergo metabolism, can grow, adapt to their environment, respond to stimuli, reproduce, and evolve. So they've put the evolution, at least in part, in the definition. And I think this is important for us to remember. When we divorce ourselves from evolution, as has happened much in our culture, because everybody's afraid to use the E word in schools and is afraid to use it in our education system, we take it out of the importance that it has for life. But evolution is actually critical for life. I'll never forget, I was invited by a pastor of a Lutheran church to give a talk about evolution without using the E word. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. So I changed my talk to make it say development and, you know, tried everything else. And then somebody in his parish asked the question, excuse me, are you really talking about evolution? And I mean, I'm not going to lie. I said, well, I am, but, you know, I was trying to make it be easier to talk about. And so then people were like perfectly fine with that. So this was a case where the pastor didn't know where his own parish was. I mean, they were obviously ready to talk about it, even if he didn't think they were. So, but I feel that divorce that we often have prevents us from understanding what life really is and where it comes from. Okay, so let me talk about evolution and genetics, because I think that genetics has actually solidified everything that we've ever believed about evolution before. Now, Dobzhansky said that people have prejudice against evolution, and that's why they don't want to have it. And I think this is actually one of the reasons. So here's this young child reading Darwin's Origin of the Species, has his pet monkey in bed with him, and he says, we're cousins? That's kind of gross. And I think it is that, like, what we're related to all these species, we're actually in a way related to animals that makes us feel like evolution is problematic for us. I don't think it should be, but it is a driving issue. So you saw me present to you Darwin's Tree of Life before. This is the tree that is no longer a tree. It's now a circle of life. And the thing of it is, this is now very old. What this is it's a showing. Every one of these bars represents a different species that has been totally sequenced for its genome. And this is the type of sequencing gel that we use to be able to identify the sequence. And it shows organisms that are close are shown close to each other. Organisms that are far away from each other. And so we can use this to show how related. And every single genome sequence that has been done verifies that evolution occurred. This is a more recent code. This circle came in 2013, and you see that we don't even have the organisms labeled here because there are so many that have been sequenced. And here we have, here are the animals, and we are here. This is us. This is humans. Here are the fungi, bacteria, the archaebacteria that live in the ocean's vents, the plants. This is now the latest circle of life. Now, why do we no longer reflect it as a tree and we reflect it as a circle? Because the tree implies that one organism is higher than another. From an evolutionary perspective, though, we are all the best evolved to live in this environment. So from an evolutionary perspective, we're sort of equal. And, you know, the worrisome thing that everybody talks about is planet Earth goes, you know, burns up in 1,000 years, or maybe it's even much less than that. And what's going to be left? They're going to be cockroaches. Okay, because they're the ones that are best suited to live in any environment. We are somewhat fragile compared to them. So this circle now is what we use, and this circle keeps growing and growing and growing. But an aspect of it that is incredible is that as we sequence every genome, we have a genetic code. The genetic code is where three bases in the genes, three sequences, three letters, make for an amino acid that eventually make for a protein. In all of life on Earth, the genetic code is identical. Bacteria use this very same code as we do. There will be one exception. I'll mention the exception in a minute because it's also interesting. So here we go. This is the genetic code. It took a very long time to figure this out, but every time there is a UUU sequence, a phenylalanine gets put in, and that happens in us, and it happens in the cockroach, and it happens in the fruit fly, and it happens in every species on planet Earth. We all have the same genetic code. But here's the exception. In our cells, our DNA is mostly living in the nucleus. So we have a center of the cell that is the nucleus where most of our genetic material sits. But you know, we have these other structures sitting inside cells. And if you took biology 101, you probably remember mitochondria, that word mitochondria. Mitochondria are these little structures that sit outside in the cytoplasm. And they are the power packs of the cell. They make for energy in the cell. Guess what? They have their own DNA. In fact, their DNA is circular. Ours is in chromosomes, so it's long. Mitochondria have circular DNA like bacteria. And there's another organelle that has its own DNA, but we don't have it in our cells, but plants do. It's called the chloroplast. So here we have the first organism here that acquired first a bacterium to live inside it to make it have a mitochondria. And then for plants, a second bacteria to live inside it that made for chloroplasts to make them green and be able to carry out energetic processes of making food. So two times in evolution, we co-opted organisms to evolution twice, co-opted organisms to live within us. So we have organisms living within organisms. Organisms living within organisms to carry out a specific function that evolved and evolved and evolved. And they had their own DNA, and we have our own DNA, and it has continued to this day. They have a different genetic code. So here we have, in all of your cells, you have a genetic code in the nucleus and a separate genetic code in the mitochondrion. What is that genetic code? It's not all so different. Here's the universal code that everybody has. Here's just the few places where it's different. In our own mitochondria, UGA in our nucleus says stop making the protein. In the mitochondria, it says put in a tryptophan. Guess what? In yeast, put in a tryptophan. AUA, universal code, put in isoleucine for AUA. In, again, our own mitochondria and those from yeast, it's put in a methionine. CUA, here we go. Mammals, our own mitochondria, make the same as the universal code, but yeast don't. And here, for this codon, arginine is the same in yeast and our nuclear DNA is a stop in our mitochondria. In all other aspects of that code, it's identical. So here we have organisms living within organisms that have a slightly different genetic code, clearly related. Why are they different? What difference, what does this make? What distinctions are there because of this? We don't know. There's a lot of work going on in this to try to understand it. Another point to make, this is actually from a paper that was only a couple of years old, and I know you can actually see every inch of these wheels that are, again, these evolutionary wheels showing the relationship of organisms. But what they're doing is they're looking at the rate of evolution among different species. And it's important to know that different species evolve at different rates. So in this example, the plug-nosed marine fish were among the slowest of the vertebrates to evolve. Why is that? Maybe because their environment doesn't change all so much. Maybe because their genetics doesn't allow them to evolve at the same rate, but they are the slowest. They take years and years to be able to make any changes. We can look at specific functions, and in this example, people have looked at the emergence of bone formation in vertebrates and have been able to show that when we start out with very first organisms, we find special genes called the spark genes. These spark genes change over time. They duplicate, they replicate in multiple different ways. We go from a single spark gene up here in the very, very simplest of organisms, the lampreys, for example, and in a full fish that's a bony fish that's got all kinds of bones, we've duplicated multiple copies of this spark gene, which appears to be important in bone formation. Now, is it identical in these species? No. It's close, but it's not identical. But because they're close, we can actually say they are related and came from a single source. So I've shown you a spattering of what we learned from some genetics. Let me summarize what we know. Genetic code is common to all of life on Earth. We all have the same genetic code. Interestingly, the more related two organisms are, the more like their gene sequences are. And the more distant two organisms are, the more unlike their genetic sequences are. We can say that all the methods that people used for years where, you know, in the old days when botanists wanted to know if organisms were related, they would go out and they would look at, like, the buds on the trees. And they would say, this has a bud that forms in this way. These two trees do the same way, and therefore they must be related. All those methods were verified by genetics. So genetics didn't overturn the old methods. It supported them. Now, there were a few surprises. Especially, you know, among dog breeds, for instance, there were a lot of surprises about which animals came from what. For instance, people thought that it was going to be a huge genetic difference from a giant Great Dane to a small little terrier. And in fact, it ended up being one or two genes that were different, and they were mostly involving growth. So there were a lot of surprises, but still it upheld what biologists had been doing since the 1700s for being able to understand relationships among organisms. Similarities among species are explained by genetic similarities in many, many cases. And I don't think I'll have the time to get into it, but for instance, think about body plan. I mean, we have a head, an abdomen, and limbs, and you know what? Insects do too. And you know what? It's the same genes in insects that make for a body plan as we have in us. So, you know, related genes make for genetic similarities. Differences are explained by genetic divergence. So when we see differences, obviously we don't have antennae like fruit flies do, but they have differences in their genes that involve body plan that make them have antennae and not us. Different species evolve at different rates, which I just pointed out to you. And species that have evolved different features, special features for their environment, often have rudimentary organisms that are reminiscent of their origin. I mean, it's like strange, but there are some children that are born with tails, right? I mean, we know examples of that. And what happens? We surgically go in and repair that. Why are they born with a tail? Because it's a rudimentary remembrance of when we had tails. Think about your wisdom teeth. I don't know, how many people in the room have wisdom teeth still? Right. Mine were out like long ago because it was damaging my jaw. Why? Wisdom teeth in the great apes, having tons of teeth to be able to chew food was actually useful. But as humans developed into being human beings, our brains got bigger and pushed out our teeth. So the teeth got sacrificed for a big brain. There are many other examples of that. That we see where there's a kind of throwback to a previous time. Okay, the link between ecology and evolution. So ecology, it comes from this great Greek word oikos, which means household, and logos, which means knowledge or study. And ecology means that it's a study of managing the household. It comes similarly to the word economics, which is about maintaining the finances of the household. Well, ecology is about studying the household itself. What do we mean by household here? The household is planet Earth. And so ecology was the first study of the interactions between organisms and their environments that allowed to know how organisms survived best or how they didn't. Now think about it for a minute. What are the drivers of evolution? Genetics and environment. environment drives the selection for what will be good and what won't be good in that particular environment. Here we have the study of the relationship between organisms and their environment. Isn't that really similar to what evolution is? It's very similar, actually. Ecology was first developed by a guy named Ernest Haeckel in 1866, sometime after, around the sort of time of Darwin, but a little bit later. He coined the term and called it the comprehensive science of the relationship between the organism and its environment. It is usually considered to be interdisciplinary. Having worked with ecologists over the years, I have learned that if you want to study the ecology of a forest, you better understand some of the geography of it. You certainly have to understand the geology of what's going on. Looking at population dynamics, which species are there, which ones aren't, which are moving in, which are moving out, have a broad understanding of statistics. It's a very interdisciplinary type of study. Eugenius Warming is actually one of the people that founded the ecology as a discipline itself and made it be an area of study at the university. He did this in the early 1900s. So what are some of the links that I think about when I think about evolution and ecology? First of all, in the U.S. universities, there are few departments of evolution and there are few departments of ecology. Most are departments of evolution and ecology. Why is that? Because they're studying similar things. And in a way, you can't think about one without thinking about the other. Understanding ecology explains some of the selection pressures that go on for organisms. So what are the selection pressures that drive evolution? And understanding evolution explains the selective pressures that populations face as they go on to develop and get selected for or against. At the end of the day, the interactions between organisms and their environment are actually very, very important for both ecology and for evolution. So these are linked. So then this leads me to say, and again, maybe somebody's going to throw tomatoes at me for this, but I believe that a failure to accept evolution leads to a failure to understand the links between organisms and their environment. So if we're afraid of that E word, we are not going to understand the other big E word, ecology, or environment, because of that concern. I believe that anti-evolution sentiment in the U.S. has also been associated with the anti-green sentiment in the U.S. And as I see anti-evolution growing in other parts of Europe, I also see that it's coming with an anti-green component as well. I'm absolutely convinced as a biologist that you cannot understand environment without understanding evolution and vice versa. At the same time, there needs to be some sort of theological reflection on this. So this is an image of Adam naming the animals. And in my tradition, I actually named my godsons. One of my godsons is named Athanasios, and he's mad at me to this day, okay? But the fact is, in my tradition, you name your godchild. Why? Because you are responsible for them. It's a way of showing that responsibility. You name your children, again, as a means of measuring responsibility. You name your pets. Some people name their farms and their homes. And what is it about? It's about those things that we are responsible for. They're not about ownership. They're about being responsible. So what is this story in Genesis when Adam is naming the animals? It's not about you own these animals. It's about you are responsible for these animals. You're going to give them the name that is the specific name that's right for them. And you're going to know what it is. And you're going to give it to them. And with that, you take responsibility. I think that this message of Genesis is often lost in that, like, dominion language and everything else. But this is the message that comes from that Genesis story. Okay, let's see. I don't have that much time. I'm going to flip through this section much as I would have liked to have talked about it and just go to some comments, some reflections at the end so that I'm able to take some questions. So I'm going to try to do a few theological reflections. First of all, Bulgakov, I think that the problem in with evolutionary thought and with thinking about evolution, and somebody said it at a talk I heard earlier today, they avoid the atom word when they're talking about courses to students because of concerns about how they might understand it. Bulgakov addressed this, I think, in a very interesting way. He said, the stumbling block for contemporary thought is that the history of the world preserves traces neither of Eden nor of the perfection of the original man, which is why the biblical story is considered only a naive legend. What should one's attitude be toward this story in the face of the existing critique? One can say that the remembrance of an Edenic state and of God's garden is nevertheless preserved in the secret recesses of our self-consciousness as an obscure anamnesis of another being. What is he saying here? What he is saying, so in many faith traditions, we remember things that are yet to come. We remember the second coming of Christ. We remember life in paradise. We remember things that we have not experienced, that have not been experienced in the history of humanity. But we are remembering things in the future. And what Bulgakov is saying here is that perhaps this is a remembrance of something that is deeply buried in our hearts, but is not actually something that humanity has yet experienced. So he's trying to say that for God, time is irrelevant. For us, time is a gift, but for God, time is irrelevant. I think this thinking is very reasonable. Bulgakov also says in another place that Genesis is not merely a history. It's a hyper-history. It is beyond history. It presents such a deep truth about who we are that we need to understand it in a very deep way. And to just take it as it is written, he says, mutilates the text. I think he's on to something here. My next reflection is on this issue of survival of the fittest. So, you know, there are lots of people who say, I need to have my own child born because I need to perpetuate my genes. And that's fine. That's what people choose to do. But we humans, we're not just about our genetic heritage. We are also about a culture that we pass on to others. So evolution operates at the level of the genes. Our genetic heritage, yes, that is evolution. That comes from evolution. It develops with evolution. But our cultural heritage, it is the experience that we accumulate from one generation to the next generation, the next generation to the next generation. It is those things that we continue to carry on with. You know, when a bird wants to fly, it had to eventually evolve wings. When humans wanted to fly, we built planes. Okay? So that creativity is part of our evolution, but it leads us to have a culture where we can pass this on to others of our kind. Some people argue with me that, you know, gorillas have a bit of a culture. Maybe they do, but they don't write books. They don't pass it on to others. They don't leave behind things that are important. I think this is a critical distinction, and it says that we're not only about our evolution. We're not only about our genetic heritage. We are about much more than that with our cultural heritage. Oops, sorry, I did something wrong. This is a quote from Francisco Ayala. Ayala is a scholar. He was writing for the journal Zygon. He's a religion and science scholar who won the Templeton Prize a few years ago. He said, biological inheritance is based on the transmission of genetic information in humans, very much the same as in other sexually reproducing organisms. But cultural inheritance is distinctively human, based on transmission of information by a teaching and learning process, which is, in principle, independent of biological parentage. Cultural inheritance makes possible the cumulative transmission of experience from generation to generation. Cultural heredity is a swifter and more effective, because it can be designed, mode of adaptation to the environment than the biological mode. The advent of cultural heredity ushered in cultural evolution, which transcends biological evolution. What he's saying is cultural evolution, which we have developed, it's much more important than biological evolution. This is what we need to focus on, is this distinction that makes us truly, truly human. All species can go through, you know, do go through biological evolution, but cultural evolution, something special. And I only have two more slides. There's a scholar who is a patriarch of the Orthodox Church. He died a number of years ago, and he brought forth a concept that there are different ways to understand nature. There is, of course, the way to understand it from a scientific perspective. But he says we're actually called to understand nature in a different way, too. It's not bad to understand it from a scientific perspective, but we need to understand it in other ways. And he said, contemplation of nature transforms nature, not in the direction of Babel, but in the direction of the New Jerusalem. When a hermit, well into the 20th century, gives poisonous snakes little cups of milk to drink, he knows them in a different way than the scientist. This is what we're called to do. We're actually called to understand our fellow creatures in a way that is different than the scientist does. It's not about discarding the science. It's about a way of enriching it to make it be something deeper than just the knowledge we put in textbooks. And finally, a comment from Metropolitan Kallistos, where he made, I think, this beautiful analogy, which I love and I often use in my courses. He talks about the word anthropos, which is the Greek word for human. And it doesn't, you know, a lot of people translate it as man, but it actually means human. It's the word for all of humanity. He says it comes from the word anathrin, which means to look up. Humans, unlike most animals, look up towards heaven. It means that we are heavenly and yet earthly. We are spiritual yet material. Our feet are placed firmly on the ground, and yet we are still lifting up our eyes to pray to the heavens. He says our human task is to be the syndesmos, which is the bond, and gefira, which is the bridge of God's creation. This, I think, is the answer to that question about contemplation and how we should think about contemplating nature. We need to understand that we are the part of nature that contemplates. We are the part that looks up. We need to continue to look up and work to have a better relationship with our earth, with each other, with the species on earth, and with everything else. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm waiting for the tomatoes.
So the next time somebody asks you to give a talk about evolution without using the word evolution, There's actually a biblical word that you could use. Lemana.
Lemana.
That's used 11 times, or a variable of it, in Genesis 1. It's translated as after her kind. If you're Moses and you're trying to explain evolution, can you think of any other Hebrew words that you could use better than after her kind or after his kind?
Certainly that is part of evolution, but I don't think it explains it all. But I don't expect Genesis to have, it's not a textbook. And I don't think that the understanding of evolution was very strong in that era. That doesn't mean they didn't have wisdom in many other ways. I'm sorry, please.
Yeah, so I'm not a biologist. Fascinating talk. But as a non-biologist, I'm curious about the definition of life and was fascinated to hear about your comments about mitochondria. And presumably mitochondria, when they were bacteria, a bacterium, would have been alive. Does that mean that they are in fact still alive in human cells? Or is that a ridiculous question to ask?
No, thank you for asking that. I mean, they don't evolve outside of our cells. So they evolve with us, they co-evolve with us. So I think biologists in general understand them as a species that has been brought in and it now lives, that we take full advantage of, okay? And in fact, now we're so related that some of the genes in the nucleus make for mitochondrial proteins and vice versa. So they can't live independently, but our own cells can't live without them either. There have been a few examples where people made cells without mitochondria, and they required very weird growth conditions and only made it for a day or two. So the interdependence has grown so great that they can't live otherwise. But thank you, that was a good question.
Yes, I want to thank you for your talk. I just wanted to clarify at the end, you're talking about the unique characteristics of humans and contemplating. Are you saying that evolution or even maybe natural selection doesn't explain those characteristics and there's a spiritual aspect there that's unique?
Well, to some extent, yes. I mean, what I want to say is that the evolution of spirituality is not quite clear biologically from a biological evolution. And it probably comes from a cultural evolution, which is distinct and not genetic. Now, there are a large number of people that are looking for the God gene. There are some people that are looking for instance, altruistic behavior as an idea of evolution. Can we find genes for altruism? So far, those have not been terribly successful. If they're going to find them, they're going to be complicated traits. I actually wrote an article about this a year ago. So I think it's going to be extremely hard to put forth. I think it's much easier to put it forth as a cultural evolution perspective, something that we developed as part of our culture that has now become critical for us.
Yeah, so I had a question about, I guess it seems like in most discussions on climate change, there's...
I don't know who's asking. Thank you.
So it seems like in most discussions on climate change, there's an emphasis on preventing loss of biodiversity, preventing extinction as a moral imperative. And I think given your comments on evolution and sort of the necessity of extinction in evolutionary processes, where would you locate the moral imperative in, a Christian worldview on climate change?
So let me make sure I understand the question. I'm not sure. To tell you the truth, there's a bit of an echo here, so it's hard to hear everything. But what you're asking about is about species diversity and loss of diversity and how that relates to environmental issue and to evolution as well. Why don't you ask again? Maybe I'll hear better.
Yeah, so I guess basically it seems like when people talk about climate change, the main problem is, you know, we want to prevent extinction of various rare species. And I think both from an evolutionary perspective where extinction is sort of a natural process and also perhaps from a creation standpoint as well, that isn't necessarily, it seems like extinction is inevitable in some ways. I'm wondering whether you still see that as preventing human-caused extinction as an important aspect of environmentalism or not.
Yeah, so let me give a... I would have talked about this in my talk, but I took it out. So there's an example in China during a period where they had the killing of the sparrows, right? And many of you maybe know this example. And the sparrows were being killed because they were eating the seeds that people were planted. So the sparrows were blamed for causing the famine. So they were blamed for the famine because they were eating the seeds. So China set out to go through and kill all the sparrows. What happened when all the sparrows got killed? Guess what? Sparrows ate locusts. Now they were overrun with locusts. The locusts came and went on the wheat and killed the wheat. So here we have a human-engineered program to try to reduce famine by killing sparrows and didn't understand all the interactions that different species have and resulted in a huge famine that killed millions of people. It is hard for humans to understand all the interactions for all the species we knock out. One need only think about the pollinators now. We're losing our pollinators. They're being replaced, and I had a map of this. In UK, you can actually see syrphids are replacing pollinators. Cirrhids are organisms, are insects that are not pollinators. We don't have nearly as much pollination going on. Most of that's almost directly related to pollution that we've contributed to. So, you know, so all species are interrelated, yes. And understanding that interrelationship is important, but it is affecting us very strongly. You know, in China right now, they're actually hand-pollinating some flowers.
Hi, thank you for your talk. My question actually has to do with something based on your background. In this audience, we're pretty well versed with the breadth of views on evolution in the Western Christian Church. I'm wondering if you could comment on the breadth of views or positions on evolution in the Eastern Church.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the tradition is does not believe in a literal interpretation of the text of Scripture. In general, most Orthodox scholars would say that there is no, I don't know of a single Orthodox scholar that would say that there's an incompatibility between evolution and what the Orthodox Church teaches. But, you know, there are a lot of individual priests and parishes who are influenced by the surrounding culture. In Russia right now, there's the swing from communism, and those are having a very big influence on the Orthodox Church too. Again, scholars do not have the problems with it. Bishops do not have the problems with it. It is in these individualized situations that there are problems. So from the teachings of the church, it's not a problem, but it becomes an issue with the individual practice. I don't know if that answered.
I think, you know, we have known for a long time Tree of Life, whether you want to call it Circle of Life. What I'm curious about is what you would say is the biggest surprise that has come out of DNA sequencing.
Most of the surprises were found to be false. So I don't have, it's like it's hard for me to think about. Okay, here was the biggest surprise. The biggest surprise was the human genome was so small. So this is a hysterically funny story, I think. So there was a giant bet that was going on among all the scientists for how big was the human genome. And you could enter a number into a website and bet a dollar. And at the end of the day, the person that guessed the right number of genes was going to take home all the money. And, you know, there's the fruit fly that's got like 130,000 genes and, you know, all these other organisms. We have to be more complicated than them. People are, you know, guessing that it's like 200,000. It's more like 30,000. It's just that we are compact and we use our DNA in pieces and put them together to make different genes by taking a piece here, a piece here, a piece here. Not for all genes, but for many. And that was the biggest surprise, that actually nobody won the bet. What they did finally is they said the lowest winner, which was around 41,000 genes, that's who they gave all the money to. So,
as the moderator, I will get a chance to ask the last question. One of the things I was really fascinated with was how you made the important distinction between biological evolution and other types, including cultural evolution. I'd like to get your response to a comment by me. It's my opinion that a lot of the conservative opposition to evolution is really conservative opposition to the way the culture is evolving, a lot more than just the biology. Would you please comment about that?
Thank you so much. That's exactly correct. Okay, so when I talk to people and I push them about what's their problem with evolution, the issues I get most often among conservative elements is number one, that I don't believe in evolution. Survival of the fittest applies to social norms and to culture and everything else. That's number one. Number two is concern about radical materialism, because evolution is, after all, material. Those are two of the most important things. And then the third thing, which was brought up in one of the plenary this morning, is about randomness, where people say, oh, if I believe in randomness, how can I possibly be, how can there be a God if there's all randomness? So those are, I think, the three critiques that I've heard that are out there. I strongly, you know, I can argue for any, you know, against all those ideas. I think that they're reasonable to think about. I think the discussion of them is important and actually enriches the dialogue. But I think that they can be argued one way or the other. I mean, I've written articles on randomness too, so. Thank you for being a great audience.